It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we catch up on the several ongoing investigations into former President Donald Trump, including a New York case that could see an indictment decision in the coming days. First, 77% of us admit to using our phones while driving. That's according to a survey from the Travelers Insurance Company last year. The survey goes on. 74% of us use cell phone maps. More than half of us read texts or emails behind the wheel. More than a fourth post or scroll through social media. One in five admit to online shopping while driving. An estimated 46,000 people died on U.S. highways in 2022. It's unclear how many of those were a result of distracted driving. Our next guest calls distracted driving an epidemic. He's calling for changes to the ways we collect safety data and the ways we look out for each other on the road. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you seen a lot of distracted driving on the road? Will you admit to being one of those many people who did things with their phones while driving just for a quick minute? Have you changed your habits? Has this affected your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Bruce Landsberg is the vice chair of the National Transportation Safety Board and is on the steering committee of the National Distracted Driving Coalition. Bruce, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be with you, Rob. This is a critically important subject for all of us.
Now, I think we all know distracted driving is pretty dangerous. What you're making the case for in your organization is that the numbers that we might have out there don't really tell the whole story. Why might we be undercounting the impact of distracted driving?
Well, the main reason is that being on the phone doesn't leave a trail. So when someone is in a crash, if they are impaired or if they've been speeding or something like that, there's a trail, if you will, that shows that this is what's going on. Unless the police are able to get a subpoena to look at your phone, or unless the driver says, hey, I was talking or chatting on my phone, we don't have that information, and law enforcement is pretty busy. If it's a fender bender, they don't pay a lot of attention to it because they got other things to do. So we think this is badly undercounted, and right now we're making a best guess estimate that the undercount is probably about three times as bad as we think. So a couple of years ago, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration tallied up over 3,400 fatalities nationwide. We think that it's probably closer to about 10,000 fatalities every year. And if you go beyond just fatalities and we go to life-altering injuries, such as burns, amputations, brain damage, et cetera, you're talking hundreds of thousands of people who have had their lives badly altered as a result of a lifestyle choice.
Big picture, Bruce, as I understand the history of traffic safety in the United States, we spent a lot of years getting safer and safer with better road design, safer cars, things like that, and we're actually starting to turn that around. Is that what you're seeing? And how big a factor in that is distracted driving and bending that curve the opposite of the way we'd want it to go?
Well, in various areas, I mean, we've been working on DUI for decades, and the whole concept of just say no hasn't worked with drugs. It hasn't worked with distracted driving or other sorts of impairment. It hasn't worked for speeding very well. And it most certainly doesn't work with personal electronic devices. The devices are basically designed to be addictive. And so people use them. We understand that. So just hoping that people won't use it, as you've seen from some of the data that you cited at the opening of the interview, is that most people are using their phones. And one thing that happened when I came to the NTSB several years ago, they said, we don't use our phones when we're driving, even if it's something critically important. We'll get a hold of you when you get to wherever it is that you're going. And the national trucking companies, such as UPS and Federal Express, they do want to talk to their drivers, but they have a system worked out where they can let the driver know, hey, we want to talk to you. But don't do it while you're driving. Find a safe place in the next 10 or 15 minutes, pull over, and we'll talk about where you need to go next. So there are ways of managing this, but we have to learn to say no. And as individuals, we don't do that very well.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the technological solutions. Are there things that the people who make our phones and their operating systems can do to make it easier for us to say no, or to not even think about it, to opt out in the first place?
Well, absolutely. First off, we think that the phones ought to be defaulted to not operating for non-driving activities when the cars are in motion. And the phone knows when the car is in motion. So far, the phone manufacturers have chosen not to do that. You have to opt in and go to your settings and do it that way. And likewise, the telecom companies could be doing something to manage this. And some people say, well, I use my navigation function. We're not talking about that. Or I listen to music. We're not talking about that. We're talking about talking on the phone, texting, as you said, online shopping, and people playing video games. We have investigated crashes where people have been playing video games or have just absolutely not been paying attention, with a very bad outcome for all concerned.
How about the cars themselves? The technology board in front of us keeps getting bigger and more complicated. Is that part of the story?
Well, I think it absolutely is. I saw one car advertisement recently that said, you know, we have a 14-inch screen. Well, where do you think people are going to be looking? And one of the things that science has done for us, they've looked at this very carefully. If you take your eyes off the road for more than about 3 seconds, the chances of being in a crash start to go up. And the longer you're off the road, the more that increases exponentially. So the science is clear. If you're not looking at the road, you are setting yourself up for a bad day.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Algoma. John, hi.
Hi. I have an Apple phone, and it has an application in it, in the operating system, actually, that allows me to have the phone automatically turn off when I'm driving the car. And I know you were talking about technological solutions, but it's a social issue. And my question is whether your guest has any sample or model legislation for state legislatures which would allow them to require that operating systems have such an application and that it be automatically turned on when you turn the car on.
Great question, John. What do we see out there, Bruce?
John, that is a fabulously good question, and the answer is yes. And the NTSB has come up with some model legislation that can be used. Obviously, the federal government does not control the state driving laws, and NTSB, we don't make rules whatsoever. We merely make recommendations. But we in the NTSB carry Apple phones as well, and we have to set them to the default, or I should say the non-default position, so that the phone knows when we're in motion and it won't buzz at us when we're doing this. So I think that's a great suggestion. If we could get the public to agree to this and to encourage their legislators to vote for it, because the lives you save will be those of your family and friends.
John, thanks for that call. We're talking to Bruce Landsberg, Vice Chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, part of the National Distracted Driving Coalition, looking at the risks of distracted driving, some possible solutions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found ways to maybe boost your willpower and not be distracted by your phone while driving? What kind of things have you seen on the road yourself? If you are in highway law enforcement in some part of it, do you have a story to share about what you've seen out there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Bruce Landsberg, Vice Chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, also with the National Distracted Driving Coalition, looking at data on distracted driving, why the numbers may be understating the problem. You can join in with your questions for our guest, your own stories or experiences at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Oconomowoc. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you? I think that with all due respect to your guest, it's much too broad an indictment against, quote, the use of cell phones currently. I have a car that's a special interest vehicle, but nonetheless, although it's 10 years old, it was equipped by its manufacturer with an automatic interface for any cell phone that you just clone to it. So anytime I wish to speak to somebody on my cell phone while driving, and I commute back and forth to Chicago at least twice a month, I don't have to do anything except press the microphone button on my steering wheel, which turns around and does everything that I would like it to do, including navigational guidance, et cetera, et cetera. What difference is there in the distinction your guest makes between A, using hands-free cell phone conversation for whatever purpose it may be? This is not game playing or a big screen that you're interacting with. It's simply totally hands-free microphone conversation. What's the difference between that and speaking to a passenger in your car on a long trip?
Tom, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Bruce, hands-free use of cell phones.
Great question, Tom. Thank you. So the academics in the group have done some study with simulators, and they find that hands-free is in fact better than manipulating the phone, which I'm sure you would agree with. The problem comes in with the fact that you are cognitively distracted, and that sounds, you know, that's a 60-cent word, for you're not devoting 100% of your attention to the driving task. And once again, the statistics seem to show that this is a problem. And one of the challenges we have is the idea that the driving environment is tremendously dynamic. And if you're in a high density traffic environment, it can be a real problem where things will change literally within seconds. And if you happen to be thinking about what you're going to say on the next part of the discussion, you may be putting yourself at a disadvantage. How is it different than talking to a passenger? It's not much different than talking to a passenger, but once again, you have total control over that situation as opposed to saying to somebody else, hey, wait, I've got a deal coming up here. The passenger can see what's going on. I'm pretty sure that, you know, a lot of people are not as responsible as you are in the use of your phone. And once again, we're seeing that. To help put this in context, in the aviation industry, we've been coming under a microscope recently, and we haven't had, there have been two fatalities in the last 10 years in scheduled airline flights. We are killing the equivalent of approximately one airliner every single week on the highways from what we estimate is due to distracted driving. Is that acceptable? That's a rhetorical question. I don't think so.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tom. Bruce, I want to bring us back to our starting point. Are there things we can do to collect data better so we can get a grasp on how big a problem distracted driving is?
Yeah, I think there are. And that would be, again, there are companies called telematics, or that's the general descriptive term, that can track these kinds of things. And there are apps that you can put on your phone. Some insurance companies are encouraging people to do that. And it gets us to a point of, you know, why are people so hooked on this? And why are the phone companies so hooked on it? It all comes down to economics. There's a lot of money to be made when people are online, whether they're driving or otherwise. And so, you know, we look at this and we say, well, I'm not going to have a crash. I've never had a crash. I'm not going to. That's what we refer to as optimism bias. And we're not very good at self-assessing how well we do. And I guess one of the key points, Rob, is every single person that was involved in a distracted driving crash, when they got in their car, was absolutely certain that it wasn't going to happen to them. And it's hard for us to get through that mindset because it's hardwired into every one of us.
Time for one more quick call from Cyril in Madison. Cyril, hi.
Hi, Rob. I just wanted to bring up an issue regarding the engineering and the software that's going into all these modern vehicles now. You have automatic emergency braking. You have blind spot warning. You have lane departure warning. You have lane keeping assistance.
I gotcha, sir. We don't have a lot of time left. But, Bruce, are these part of the solution, those things that slow you down when the car in front of you slows down?
Absolutely. We're a big belief in the driver-assisted equipment. We're a long ways yet, though, from the fully automated vehicles that you hear so much about. Until we get to being fully automated, I think we're going to have to be really careful about how we divert our attention from the roads.
Thanks for that call, Cyril. And Bruce, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you. And everybody, please, the call can wait. Get to your destination.
That's Bruce Landsberg, vice chair of the National Transportation Safety Board and part of the National Distracted Driving Coalition. He joined us today with a look at distracted driving and possible solutions. You can keep sharing your thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Wisconsin voters will choose a new state Supreme Court justice next month, with the ideological lean of the court hanging in the balance. The new court will be asked to weigh in on any number of hot-button issues, including the state's abortion ban. But it could also consider a challenge to the state's political district maps, which have been called among the most gerrymandered in the nation. As Bridget Bowden reports, it has the potential to shape the state's political landscape for years to come.
In statewide elections in Wisconsin, sometimes Republicans win. Sometimes it's Democrats. But when it comes to which party controls the legislature, it's never close. With the help of the redistricting plan they first drew more than a decade ago, Republicans win every time. In 2015, Wisconsin Democrats thought they had the answer to this, a new standard to measure gerrymandering that would give federal courts the ability to decide when maps were too partisan. They took the idea all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. But the day they made their arguments, it was obvious that some of the justices weren't ready to go there.
And it may be simply my educational background, but I can only describe a sociological gobbledygook.
A couple years later, the Supreme Court slammed the door to the idea that partisan gerrymandering could be solved in federal courts. But according to University of Wisconsin-Madison law professor and redistricting expert Rob Yablon, that wasn't the end of the road.
The court in that decision explicitly left the door open for state courts to consider partisan gerrymandering claims under their own state constitutions.
And that's why the maps are a huge issue in this year's race for an open seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, where liberal Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz is facing conservative former Justice Dan Kelly. If Protasiewicz wins, it would flip the ideology of the court for the first time since 2008. And that could be big for Wisconsin's maps, Yablon says, because someone could challenge them in court.
I have little doubt that if the court's composition changes, someone is going to try to pursue that case.
The state's current maps were drawn by Republican legislators in 2021. They were based on maps that Republicans drew 10 years before. In that time, the GOP has held strong control of both houses of the legislature, even in years when Democrats did well in statewide elections. Yablon says different maps might change that.
If the Wisconsin Supreme Court adopted new maps, those maps would by no means guarantee that the Democrats would take control of the legislature, but it would at least raise the possibility that there would be a meaningful fight for legislative control.
That could open the door to any number of policy changes that Democrats haven't been able to pursue in recent history, like expanding Medicaid, legalizing marijuana, and codifying abortion rights. Protasiewicz, the candidate backed by Democrats, says she'd like to take a fresh look at the maps.
So let's be clear here. The maps are rigged, bottom line. Absolutely, positively rigged. They do not reflect the people in this state.
Protasiewicz stops short of saying how she would rule in a redistricting lawsuit, saying she's merely expressing her values. Kelly, the candidate backed by Republicans, takes issue with that.
I think when someone tells you what their values are in answer to a legal question, they're telling you how they're going to decide a case.
He defends the maps and says personal values shouldn't come into play when deciding a legal question. Rick Essenberg is the president of the conservative Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. He says even if a map challenge were to be brought before the state Supreme Court, he doubts a violation of the Wisconsin Constitution could be proven.
The problem is that there really isn't anything in the Wisconsin Constitution other than a requirement that the maps be contiguous and compact. And the thing about the maps in Wisconsin is that they are contiguous and compact.
But Jeff Mandel, board president of the liberal group Law Forward, believes there are provisions in the Wisconsin Constitution that the maps violate. He says there's no hard and fast plan for how to challenge the maps yet.
But there are plenty of conversations going on about what such a lawsuit would look like, who would be included, what claims it would make, and how it would proceed.
If the court flips, he says it's likely a challenge is filed pretty quickly. The new justice will be seated on August 1st. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
On a related note, join us tonight at 7 for a rebroadcast of this week's Wisconsin Supreme Court candidate debate. Former Supreme Court Justice Dan Kelly and Judge Janet Protasiewicz participated in the State Bar of Wisconsin's candidate debate yesterday. You can hear that rebroadcast again. That's tonight at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio, or stream it at WPR.org. Coming up after the news, a Manhattan grand jury did not meet today regarding their investigation into former President Donald Trump. We'll talk about what we do know about that case and what could happen if the grand jury decides to support an indictment of the former president. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, two species of bats we have here in Wisconsin are on their way to the endangered species list. We'll learn more about the role they play in the ecosystem and how to protect them. Now, a former American president has never been indicted. Could that change? A grand jury in Manhattan has been weighing that question, considering a case brought against former President Trump by the Manhattan District Attorney. We're going to talk about the case itself, the significance and possible scenarios that could play out if the grand jury were to support that indictment, and get a reminder of the other known investigations into the former president, who's also a current candidate for president. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the case in Manhattan in particular? Do you think in that case the former president should be indicted, could be, why or why not? What do you see as the possible political impact of all of this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's the author of the book Politainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics. David, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure to be here again.
Now let's dig into this Manhattan case. So this is the one involving payments made to the adult film star who performs under the name Stormy Daniels in the run-up to the 2016 election. Can you walk us through that case, the timeline, and why it could lead to an indictment?
Okay, so we don't have all the details at this point because the grand jury is still secret, you know, in terms of what's happening. But here's what we think we know, is that Michael Cohen was an attorney representing Donald Trump. He appeared to have made some payments to Stormy Daniels back in 2016. And the purpose of it appeared to be to keep her from talking up. This was the allegation, to keep her from talking about an alleged affair or sexual relationship that she'd had with Donald Trump. Michael Cohen then sought reimbursement from Donald Trump for this payment. the whole case hinges on really sort of that connection there. Donald Trump is arguing and saying, I never authorized this. This was never for the purposes of paying her off. Additionally, what's alleged in this case here is that the payment to Stormy Daniels came not from Donald Trump's, let's say, personal bank account, but from his business. And then he tried to conceal that payment. And therefore, what we think is going on here, what we think is the primary legal issue, is whether or not under New York state law, Donald Trump personally authorized and was involved in the efforts to conceal a payment, basically a form of business fraud. Additionally, we think, but we don't know, there may be arguments here that tie into whether or not this is an illegal corporate contribution under New York state and perhaps under federal law. And the reason why I say we keep thinking is that grand jury proceedings are secret. You know, we don't know exactly what the legal theories are, but that's what we think it is. And we should also point out that the Manhattan borough, that's New York City, prosecutor has already secured a successful prosecution against the Trump Organization for I believe it was for fraud already, for some fraud at this point. And so this is growing out of that investigation.
Now, this is a former president of the United States. These are actions that were taken prior to him being president, being prosecuted after he's president. A lot of concerns about possible investigations and indictments of President Trump stopped because he was the president at the time of the actions or the time of the investigations. Is the timeline pre the election, post his leaving office, is that important here?
It is important because dating back to the time when Richard Nixon was president, when there was questions regarding whether or not Richard Nixon could be indicted while still sitting as president because of the events growing out of Watergate, there was a grand jury proceeding that was not sure if the president could be indicted. They named him, the famous phrase, an unindicted co-conspirator. He resigned from office, possibly facing criminal indictment, and then Gerald Ford pardoned him, and therefore that resolved that issue. But while he was still president, the Justice Department had released a memo saying that a sitting president cannot be indicted because of a variety of constitutional issues, questions regarding, let us say, incapacitating the president to perform his duties. And that same argument was also argued at the time when Kenneth Starr was trying to impeach Bill Clinton back in the 1990s for committing perjury. What I'm getting at here is that there is a received opinion from the Justice Department that a sitting president cannot be indicted, but by universal agreement, when a president is no longer president, he's a private citizen and therefore could be indicted and subject to charges like anybody else. But what makes this so interesting now, and I was talking about this in my class yesterday, one of my law school class, is let's say he were to be indicted, that is Donald Trump, but the trial takes a while before we get to it. And let us say he gets elected president of the United States before he's actually had a trial. Could his re-election and being sworn in as president of the United States delay the trial? We don't have an answer to that question at this point. We're kind of off into a constitutional limbo land that we've never had to address before.
One other question. The former president predicted he was going to be arrested yesterday. That hasn't happened. The grand jury now hasn't met today. So we're not going to have an answer at least until tomorrow, possibly later. Supposing there were an indictment with a high profile case like this, would someone show up and, you know, arrest the former president, or are these kind of things negotiated? What happens?
Well, if it was just sort of most of us out here, it would probably be what the police would show up and they would arrest us, and that would be it. There would be no prior notice. But in the case of somebody like the president and I hate to say this, that we oftentimes have a dual justice system or more affluent people, what would happen is that the prosecutor would call up, let's this case, Trump's attorney and say, we have a warrant for his arrest. Would your client voluntarily surrender? Can we work out a time, place, and so forth for it to happen? And that's what I suspect is going to happen in this situation too, if he were to be indicted. And so this is what I thought was interesting last week. When Trump sends the message out and says he's going to be arrested on Tuesday, my first thought was to say, did his attorneys get a call from the Manhattan Borough prosecutor? They didn't. And I suspect, given the fact that there's concerns about demonstrations, disturbance of the peace and so forth, I still think that's what's going to happen. There's going to be a notice given to his attorneys. It doesn't look like it's going to happen, I think, in the next few days, if it's going to happen at all. Because as you pointed out at the top of the story here, the grand jury didn't meet today. I don't know where they are, but my suspicion is it's just not going to happen this week if something is going to happen.
Talking to David Schultz from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota School of Law, looking at possible indictments of former President Donald Trump. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234 about the Manhattan case or other investigations ongoing. Your thoughts, what do you want to see happen and not happen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, I'll ask you to take off your law hat and switch to your political science hat now. Members, Republican committee leaders in Congress put out a statement saying, hey, we want to talk to this Manhattan prosecutor. Can you talk a little bit about the political response to even the thought of a possible indictment of the former president here?
Well, it cuts in lots of different ways politically. Let's first think about what happened for the last few days, which I thought from a political perspective, at least short term, was brilliant for Donald Trump, who's always understood how to master the news cycle. You know, over the last few days, he basically has been the story. He's also been able to basically take the oxygen away from and media attention away from Ron DeSantis, his perhaps main challenger for the Republican nomination. And he's also been able to raise millions of dollars and get a lot of Republicans to rally to support him. So he has helped solidify the Republican base behind him by kind of portraying himself as what the persecuted, the politically persecuted Republican who's being gone after by a Democrat in Manhattan. Now, longer term, let us say we sketch this out further. Let's say he is indicted. I don't see how him appearing in an orange jumpsuit, you know, reference to what you know, if he were incarcerated or arraigned or something like that, or booked with his mugshot, I don't see how this helps him longer term with, let us say, independent voters, which he needs. I don't know if it plays well with the, let us say, more moderate Republicans, but it certainly, I think, solidifies his base. The other thing that I wonder here, and I'd be curious if any callers want to call in on this, given the nature of this case in Manhattan, which involves an adult, film star and so forth, I just wonder if there's a gender breakdown here. You know, will men and women view this case or view the facts of this case differently? I don't know if anybody wants to call in and sort of speculate on that, but I've been wondering about that, and I don't know what your thoughts are.
You can join in and share those thoughts at 800-642-1234 as we talk to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, looking at the ongoing investigations into former President Donald Trump, including one for which Trump himself signaled he could be indicted for this week. That's the one in Manhattan, the hush money payments to a former adult film star. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about investigations into former President Donald Trump with David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Let's go to your calls now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. Well, I have a couple of things. As far as what David brought up, as far as Stormy Daniels, that could be private, like it would be with Monica Lewinsky and Clinton. But as far as the money fraud, that's another matter. Now, my questions are, if Trump would be elected again and that delays this case, what about the statute of limitations? And if Trump would try to leave the country, would Secret Service agents, as federal agents, be required to stop Trump from leaving?
Dennis, thanks for the call. On statute of limitations, David, I was reading up on this. As I understand it, technically, from 2016, the statute of limitations in New York would have wrapped up, except there's an exception if you've lived out of the state during that time. So Washington, D.C. and Florida, so the former president's back on the clock. What are your thoughts on that and Dennis's other question?
Sure. So given the New York state law, which they put into effect, you know, a couple of years ago because of the pandemic, I'm guessing it would still toll or extend. What I mean by that is that they could probably still bring the case at a future point after he's no longer president of the United States, because it's been delayed because of why? He's not a resident of the state. Or if they've indicted him before president, they might very well at that point say, okay, there's an indictment. He's awaiting trial. Trial will be delayed until after he's no longer president of the United States. And remember, since he's already won one term, if he wins a second term, he would be precluded under the Constitution for running for a third term. The other issue is that it's very common for, especially, let's say, people who white collar criminals or people who are charged as white collar criminals to lift their passports to say that they can't travel. This raises a really interesting question here, is that we expect the president of the United States to travel, you know, to other countries to meet with diplomats. Like, is it today or tomorrow? Biden is going to be up in Canada, you know, meeting with, you know, Prime Minister Trudeau. So that is a really interesting question here, is that would they lift the president's passport and preclude him from leaving the country because we would consider him what? A risk of flight. Again, we don't know the answer to that question, but if it were anybody else, the answer would be yes, the passport would be lifted.
Thanks for that call. Yordis joins us now in Colfax. Yordis, hi.
Hi. I have a lot of questions, but the main one is his lawyer, his so-called fixer, went to prison for this crime, for paying Stormy Daniels the $130,000. Now, how come no one ever talks about that? That's actually been proven in court, and he has served his time. And how does that relate to Trump? It should directly relate to Trump.
Yordis, thanks for the call. Yordis referring to Michael Cohen, who I believe has been a frequent contributor to the grand jury so far, David.
No, this is actually a really good question here, because the principal witness against Donald Trump, as far as we know, is Michael Cohen. Now, we don't know if there are any other records or documents at this point, but assuming it's Michael Cohen, I sketched out a scenario with my students yesterday that says, okay, so we go to trial, Michael Cohen, given his background, given the convictions and so forth, testifies. Let us say, for the sake of argument, Donald Trump testifies and says, I had nothing to do with this. Michael Cohen was on his own. The job of the jury is to assess competing credibilities and determine who they can trust. This is a really good question here. You know, who's the jury going to trust at this point? Or are they going to trust Donald Trump? Or are they going to trust Donald Cohen? And so your caller raises an incredibly important here, is that the perhaps critical witness in this case is certainly not a model citizen, but is a convicted felon that has a lot of baggage attached to him.
And Yordis, I think, making the case that because Michael Cohen was successfully prosecuted, now, I didn't go to trial. He pled guilty, I think, before ending up in a trial.
I think she's
making the case that there's a precedent that should, in her opinion, I think, affect former President Trump.
Yes, I think that's absolutely correct there. Yes. And that could cut in the direction of saying that it provides the critical linkages. But at the same time, it could be that he is such a discredited witness that the linkage that you need to make from Stormy Daniels to Michael Cohen to Donald Trump gets broken at that point. So I think it cuts a couple of different ways. And this is going to be the job of the jurors, if it goes to a jury trial, if in fact he's indicted, to make that assessment.
Thanks a lot for that call. You're at us at 800-642-1234. Linda joins us now in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hello. Hello.
Hi, what did you want to bring up, Linda?
Well, I tell you, that woman is either a W or a P. I'll give you the first and a letter so you can fill in what words I mean. And I think I'm from New York, and we knew him back then in New York. You know, the trouble is really not even so much him. It's the people who back him and who think he's wonderful and can't do anything wrong. He could kill somebody in the middle of Times Square and they'd still cheer him on.
Linda, thanks for the call. David, Linda alluding to something that former President Trump had said himself. But, people can operate on the edges of the law, but not necessarily cross the line into doing something illegal. Is it likely that former President Trump will evade, as Linda, I think, fears from the way she said that, will evade prosecution?
Again, it's possible he will, you know, but it's true. The benefit of the doubt goes to, you know, to citizens. Remember, we have a presumption of innocence, you know, until proven guilty. And until we've been proven to have crossed the line, even if we skirt right at the edges of that line between legality and criminality, as long as you stay on the legality line, I mean, you're okay. We may not like it. We may not like the ethical behavior, but certainly we have to give to Donald Trump also that same presumption, you know, of innocence. But she also raises another quick point I want to raise here is that, and again, I'm from New York also originally too. A lot of what's playing out here, I think also, is inside New York City politics. You know, there's a lot of personalities here that are New York. It's a Manhattan borough prosecutor. It's Donald Trump from New York, Michael Cohen, New York. There's a certain sense in which we're taking Manhattan, Manhattan parochial politics and putting it on the national stage. And that's for good or for bad, a little of what's going on here too.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to take us outside of Manhattan in our last couple of minutes, David, and tour other investigations going on. We've got Georgia. What are you watching for there? This is in regard to a potential indictment for interfering with the outcome of the 2020 election.
Yeah, we know that the grand jury has already finished their deliberations. They have submitted a recommendation to the prosecutor. Prosecutor's deciding what to do. In fact, I think, what was it, a couple of weeks ago, one of the jurors kind of did like the 15 minutes of fame and on a speaking tour. So we know something's been released there, or something's happened there. We don't know what. But we have two other investigations, at least at the national level. One of them with a special prosecutor surrounding the documents at the Mar-a-Lago regarding whether or not there's any type of violation of federal laws there. And then we have a recommendation from the January 6th committee over to Merrick Garland, the attorney general, surrounding the events of January 6th. And in that report, the January 6th report, there's at least a half a dozen recommendations regarding possible criminal prosecution or charges against Donald Trump. And then there still could very well be out there a criminal investigation or charges related to, again, federal charges regarding election interference in Georgia. So we have three or four others. And I should point out there, you know, collectively, all of these are felons and pretty significant. What I am suspecting is that if there's an indictment here in Manhattan, this might be the springboard for other indictments. And I say that because I don't think, no matter what people may think, whether they like or hate Donald Trump, it's going to be a sad day in American society to say that a former president of the United States has been indicted. This is just not good for us. But I think once the first indictment comes down, it's almost like breaking the dam, and you might see other indictments come from other jurisdictions.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks for navigating a lot of ifs for us today.
My pleasure, and thank you very much for having me again, and thanks to the listeners.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. We talked to him today about the case before a grand jury in Manhattan that's weighing whether to be the first to indict a former president and other investigations into Donald Trump. Keep following these stories at WPR.org. We'll have updates from our colleagues at NPR there as well. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, the candidates for Wisconsin's state Supreme Court seat, the open seat there, join the show in the run-up to next month's election. A lot at stake there. It'll determine, as they say, the ideological balance of the state Supreme Court and affect a lot of big issues as well. Do you have a question you want to see one of those candidates answer? You can email it in right now, hand it along to Kate, and then tune in tomorrow. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org with your questions for a candidate or both of the candidates for Wisconsin's state Supreme Court. Then join the program tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. There are a lot of Badgers here in Wisconsin, the sports fan kind of Badger. And on big game days, especially in Madison, there are enough of them wandering through town to stop traffic for a while. But another group of Badgers upped their game and stopped a train, actually lots of trains. As reported by the Associated Press, groups of Badgers, the animal kind, in the Netherlands have burrowed under railroad tracks, causing a lot of delays and cancellations. This is the Netherlands. They have a lot of those dikes that control the water, and apparently these badgers are burrowing into the dikes where train tracks cross them, and that makes for a potential hazard for the train. Badgers are a protected species in the Netherlands, so it'll take a little work to get them out. According to the rail company website, quote, living together with badgers can be a real puzzle. No problem. Send over the UW-Madison marching band for a special fifth quarter performance. The badgers will march away right behind them. And the band gets a cool field trip along the way. Win-win solutions. This is Central Time.